I'm not fond of South Philly or how my neighbors love ICP. That's the Wonder Years. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus. First of all, that's back-to-back Wonder Years, but when you're playing Philadelphia, there are only so many bands who constantly sing about that. Second, the opening lyric is a lie because obviously we are a pro-Juggalo show here at Jay's Talk Plus. But got to get some digs in at Philly, and there's nobody better to do that than the Wonder Years. We'll see if the Jays can get some digs in at Philly in this quick two-game set. 7 o'clock tonight, 3 o'clock tomorrow. Chris Bass against Tyler Phillips tonight. Bowden Francis against Christopher Sanchez tomorrow. Tomorrow's battle, two of the biggest kind of standout breakout performances of the season on the starting pitching side. Jays had a busy weekend. They had yesterday off, of course, so a couple of the guys down, you know, fishing in the lake on their off day. But it was a busy one. They lost 2-0 on Friday. We'll catch you up if you missed it. Kevin Gausman had an okay start, but the Jays only managed 7 singles, no walks, no extra base hits, 0-for-4 with runners in scoring position, just nothing doing against Pablo Lopez the entire game. Then Saturday rolls around. They win 15-0. Will Wagner has 5 hits. Nathan Lucas has 4. Vlad and Spencer Horwitz have 3 each. Jose Berríos gives them a good outing. Not that he particularly needed to. 15 runs of support in that one. And then Sunday was a tight one. Chad Green blows a save for the first time this year. It wasn't your traditional save situation, but obviously you can blow a save in the 8th inning as well. He gives up a 3-run shot to Royce Lewis. Ernie Clement had a nice game. He had 2 hits, a homer, a stolen base, kind of a fantasy special. And then a bit of an odd one for Yariel Rodriguez, 3 shutout innings, but worked through trouble. We heard after the game that this is kind of how they're going to manage him from here as he nudges up against a vague but not entirely hard cap on his innings for the season. Yesterday, also, the Blue Jays played the least experienced lineup in franchise history in terms of career plate appearances to date, as well as the least experienced lineup in the majors this year. So by age, it doesn't quite get there because so many other prospects are, you know, Spencer Horwitz a little older, Ernie Clement's a little older, Will Wagner's a little older, etc. But by plate appearances, that was the least experienced lineup in the history of the Toronto Blue Jays and in all of Major League Baseball this season, which is crazy when there's a team out there that's already lost over 100 games. They have played Andrew Benintendi and Paul DeJong and Kevin Pillar a lot. So they have somehow not had a less experienced lineup than that. Not many updates from a roster standpoint, other than that Brandon Eisert and Luis De Los Santos were the September call-ups. I'd imagine the Eisert spot will get churned a lot. The Jays also claimed Dylan Tate off of waivers over the weekend. They optioned him to AAA. That could just be a timing thing. I'd imagine we'll see him in the major leagues before long. He has an ERA just south of 4 over the last 4 seasons working out of the Orioles bullpen. Still has 1 year of ARB control if the Jays wanted to go down that route with him. So reasonable guy to get a look at. Paolo Espino gets DFA'd as a result. But that's about it. That catches you up pretty much. None of the teams in the organization were in action yesterday. So let's talk about that least experienced lineup in franchise history from Sunday. Let's talk to our pal Julia Kreutz of MLB.com. Julia, how we doing?
Speaking of inexperience, Blake.
Wow. That's it? That's all you're going to leave me with? Okay. Julia.
I'm sorry, buddy.
The headline item for you, I think, from the September roster machinations is your guy Luis De Los Santos is back. I know we talked about this when he first got optioned down. Were you happy to see that one? What'd you think that he was the one that got the call?
Yeah, surprising a little bit to see him back so soon, I'm not going to lie. But it does make sense, right, Blake? He played pretty well when he was here. He played pretty well when he went back down to AAA. And it's nice that the Blue Jays recognize that. At the same time, there were so many guys that we could be having this conversation about. I think I was even more interested in the Brandon Eisert move because I understand that it's a fortifying the bullpen type of move. But again, you kind of have to switch your focus a little bit to the bullpen because there's so much that needs to get done there from now until the next season. And the Blue Jays are going to see what kind of internal options they have too, right? So this is a interesting start to September. And I'm kind of curious to see where things go from here.
Yeah, let's stay on the bullpen side to start then. There are currently 9 relievers in the bullpen because the roster's expanded. They do have 5 off days or 4 more off days in September. So, you know, they could stretch out the rotation that way. I was not surprised that Jake Bloss wasn't the call yet, but would you be surprised if we don't see Jake Bloss in a, you know, whether it's a six-man rotation or a spot start here and there throughout this month?
I would 100% expect that to be under heavy consideration here, Blake. Obviously, you kind of want to see a little bit more of him. You want to see how he grows in AAA right now. But this is a guy that is very much going to be a part of the Blue Jays' future. So if you can have a look at him in this final month of the season, and I know that the Blue Jays are, quote-unquote, surging a little bit and whatever, but we are still very much looking at 2025, then, yeah, you should have a look at Jake Blocks at some point before the regular season ends here.
And for anyone who's looking at these kind of things, Jake Blocks is starting today for AAA, so he would be lined up on the same day as Chris Bassitt, although there's another off day Thursday. Things are going to get juggled like crazy over with four off days and only 23 games remaining. Julia, you mentioned, you know, this time for the bullpen is about seeing what you've got with some of these guys. And there are nine guys in the bullpen right now. There are six more healthy relievers on the 40-man at AAA, including Dylan Tate, who they claimed over the weekend. This doesn't have to be specific to a particular guy who's going to get a shot here. But in general, when we're looking at this type of guy who's trying to show something for 2025, is trying to justify still having a 40-man spot as we head into the winter and Rule 5 protections and things like that, what are you looking for from these kind of fringe relievers when they come up?
Yeah, it's to put it very simply, Blake, in terms of like how a manager would put it, throwing strikes, right? And it does kind of just boil down to that at this point. Obviously, the Blue Jays are going to take a closer look at stuff and metrics and underlying numbers and all of that. We know that this is a team that really, really values that more analytical part of the game. But in order for you to have any chance of success here, you kind of need to come in and throw strikes and really trust yourself, stay in the zone, and then go from there. Because these fringe guys are also guys that the Blue Jays haven't had necessarily a ton of time to look at on the major league level. And obviously spring training kind of brings them an opportunity to do that and work and kind of, I don't know, tinker a little bit more than you can during the regular season. So right now, this is all about seeing where the command is, where the trust is, maybe where the velocity is, and then you can kind of take that preliminary information, let's say, and apply it into spring training so that you can start building this bullpen for 2025, which won't be an easy task. Like, you kind of look at what we have right now in that pen, you know that there's going to be work to do if the Blue Jays are serious about competing in 25.
Yeah, definitely. There is, I don't know, you might end up with a good AAA bullpen out of this. Maybe a couple of these guys stick around, but we're talking like you're going to have to go out and add 3-4 names at least and then hope for, you know, hey, Chad Green is this good at 34 and Jordan Romano bounces back and things like that. On the relief pitcher side, the samples are just so small, right? Like, even if a guy gets used heavily the rest of the way here, like, we're talking about 7-8 innings maybe that we get a look. On the position player side, at least we get a little bit more information, right? Like, we've seen Will Wagner for 60 plate appearances now. It's not the largest sample in the world, but we can see these guys a little closer to every day. So obviously on the hitter side, it's not as simple as throw strikes. What are you looking for from this group of guys? Like, there are, you know, 13 guys rotating through eight spots the rest of the way. So maybe we don't even see enough of the, we don't see these guys every day, but what is front of mind when you see a Will Wagner, a Luis De Los Santos, a David Schneider trying to figure it out over this last 23 games here?
Yeah, these guys are in such different positions too, right, Blake? Because Will Wagner comes in and it's pretty historic again, like kind of what we saw from David Schneider last year at this time. And you kind of just wait and see if he can maintain that. I think that he kind of came very much as advertised here in the sense that the plate approach is very, very good. The baseball IQ is pretty high. You can really see that this young man grew up with a very high level of baseball kind of in his DNA, if you will, which is very, very true. And it's translating immediately. But we also saw David Schneider come in last year, absolutely dominate. And then this year it has been a completely different story. So it's really about how can they stay within the approach that has gotten them here? That to me is number one. It's the not trying to do too much. It's the not trying to show that you belong, because if you're trying to show that you belong, then that's where you, when you stop sort of, fitting into what the Blue Jays are trying to build up here. Something else that is, kind of interesting to look at is the defensive side of things. We saw Luis De Los Santos, who's someone who's, been pretty good defensively for most of his minor league career, commit a couple of errors in that finale against the Twins, and errors that were, kind of easy plays to make. And you could see that there was just a blip in concentration and things like that. So you look at the level of commitment to staying within what has made them good. And with Schneider specifically, it's just, can he bounce back from this slump, this prolonged slump that we're seeing? And, a little bit of bad luck, too. There have been a couple of calls at the plate that you kind of are left scratching your head, being like, how is that a strike? And then he's been a little bit more vocal about that as well. But he knows what he has to do, and he's usually very honest about where he is and what kind of adjustments he needs to make. But when you're at the plate, it's a split second, and that's the time that you have to make a decision. I still believe that a guy like Schneider can get out of it because he understands it better than, most guys his age, what it is that he has to do. He has not come up as a top prospect. He's had to fight for every inch of what he's gotten. And when he says, I believe that I belong here, you have to take that into consideration as well. This is someone that is putting in the work. And now, I can understand if people are getting a little bit frustrated in the waiting game here, but you kind of have to see how this last month goes and then perhaps make a decision for next year when the spring training wraps. But I do believe that Schneider is still very much a part of this team.
Yeah, and I think that's really well said. And show me the prospect who came up and didn't hit a single bump in the road on the way. The list would be like Bobby Witt Jr., and that's basically it. Mike Trout got optioned down. Aaron Judge got a late start to his career. Not that Davis Schneider is going to be Mike Trout and Aaron Judge, but everyone goes through this. And I think the further you go down the hierarchy of prospect status, the more likely it is one of these guys is going to struggle. So Davis Schneider did get a start on Sunday. It was his first start in six games. He only played half the game. When it comes to how this playing time is going to shake out from here, obviously we all want to get a long look at each of the kids, right? But there are, like I said, there are 13 guys or 12 guys for eight spots. If we put the two catchers aside, because they're splitting their catcher duty, 12 guys for eight spots every day. On Sunday, all these guys got in the game because Springer, Varsho, and Vlad all sat out in that one. Obviously, they're not going to sit Vlad very much. It's important to him that he posts. He's among the league leaders in total playing time and plate appearances and things like that over the last couple of seasons. He's just not going to sit down a lot. What do you think the logical extension of, hey, we're going to get Springer and Varsho some off days here and there is? Like they're not... They can't. This isn't like basketball where you could just sit your vet down for the last 15 games and tank or whatever. Yeah. How do you see the playing time shaking out the next little bit?
Yeah, I think those are very two different scenarios with Springer and Vlad. Mm-hmm. I would expect Springer to get a couple more DH days in there for sure. And if the Blue Jays want to sit him and make sure that he is okay physically, which he has been, I don't think that the physical side has been a huge, huge concern for Springer as it was when he was still playing center for sure. But with Vlad, I would not expect him to sit out a whole lot. This is, like you said, Blake, this is important to him and it's important to the Blue Jays too. You kind of want to see exactly where Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is and exactly how sustainable the hot streak is, because this is all very informative for both sides here entering an off season that is going to be very important when it comes to extension talks and free agency talks are going to start. And so this is an important stretch in more ways than one here for the Blue Jays. It's definitely a chance to take a look at some guys like even Nathan Lucas, right? We haven't seen a whole lot of this year. Will Wagner for sure. But then you kind of also want to see where Vladdy is and exactly how enthused, let's put it like that, he is to play for this team in this final month that is probably not going to amount to much. And then you again, you have more data to make a decision for when it starts mattering again. Again, not that it doesn't matter now, Blake, but we know that everything right now is geared toward next season.
Yeah, look, I'm looking at the reverse standings as much as I'm looking at the right side up standings, you know? We can be honest about that, but still want to see the individual. Like, yeah, you want everyone to play well in a loss, basically, is where they're at right now. And Vlad, you know, obviously some statistical milestones matter to guys too, right? Like Vlad's sniffing 30 and 100 again here and has an outside shot at a batting title. It would require Bobby Witt Jr. to cool off significantly, but still an outside shot at a batting title there, which is, you know, another factor there. So obviously, look, we just kind of highlighted there are not that many. There are lots, 23 games worth of reps to go around, but again, 12 guys kind of jockeying for eight positions here. Is there anyone else at the AAA level you'd want to get a look at down the stretch here? Or you know, again, the playing time is there in AAA in a way that maybe it's not going to be at the major league level if you're, you know, a Luis De Los Santos type.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would absolutely love to see a guy like Jonathan Class A come in and see what he can do, right? I've been excited about the speed since the Blue Jays acquired him. This is a guy that has some major league experience, so you're not just throwing someone that's completely green out there. And it would be pretty fun, to say the least. And again, it would be informative for the Blue Jays. We have covered Jake Bloss. I do believe that it would be in the Blue Jays' best interest to at least have a look at him at the major league level this season before spring training starts, so that they can, you know, maybe gather a little bit more data on him. And maybe, you know, from the fringe here, you look at a guy like Alan Roden, who has acquitted himself pretty well at AAA this year. His ETA per MLB pipeline to get to the majors is this year, 24-year-old. You kind of wonder as well if this is a guy that is going to get a chance here. And I think that he should. I think that this is a guy that's been with the organization for a while and has kind of shown the profile, the hitting profile, that is something that the Blue Jays appreciate. And, you know, can you kind of expect him to at least get a couple of looks here as well?
Yeah, he's the toughest one for me because I understand why he's not up here right now. Like, he doesn't need a 40-man spot until after next year. But right. I think he's a guy. I you know, he's been on the show. I like talking to him. Everything I hear from a scouting perspective, he's got the stat profile that, like, when I do all my, like, auto sorts and stuff like that, he always kind of floats to the top of it in the same way that Spencer Horwitz did for a long time. But Spencer Horwitz was also, like, 26, 27. So it'd be interesting to see if he gets a look. Last one before I let you go here, Julia, just because we won't talk to you tomorrow. Bowden Francis will start tomorrow. What is Taylor Ward's problem? I know you were the one that he gave that quote to the other Saturday. Obviously, the Jays had a lot of fun with that. Did you have a lot of fun with that, too, getting to cover the kind of, I guess, devil's advocate side, talking to the Angels after that one?
I must say I did not, Blake. Yeah. As the non-confrontational person that I am, it was even, you know, weird tweeting about it because you kind of know that things are going to escalate and you're like, oh my God, if he gets plunked the next game, like, am I responsible? I don't want that on my conscience. But, you know, to his credit, obviously it was a tough one. It was a tough series overall for the Angels in terms of hitting. And he said it. You could kind of see that he maybe regretted it immediately, walked it back the next day, said that he obviously didn't want to take anything away from Bowden Francis. But the truth of the matter is that I think there's a little bit of truth on both sides here. Right, Blake? Francis was phenomenal, and you cannot take anything away from him. When you carry a no-hitter into the ninth inning, it means that you're doing a lot of things right. At the same time, the Angels did miss a couple of pitches that were straight down the middle that could have been something and just weren't. But that speaks at once to how incredible Bowden Francis is right now. And, you know, another evidence of that is that he did it again against the Red Sox his very next outing. And how much the Angels have been struggling offensively.
Yeah, and look, Taylor Ward, congrats to him. He's on a 12-game hit streak here. The Angels are 3-9 in those 12 games, and this is the highlight of the Angels season, Taylor Ward being on a 12-game hit streak while they lose a bunch. Julia, thank you for sharing that. Thanks for taking the time out today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, Blake. Anytime.
Julia Kreutz of MLB.com. Okay, so some stuff to unpack from there. Also, just a heads up, we'll do some text line stuff today. You could text us 590-590, standard data and message rates. May apply. I've got a couple from last week that I wanted to check off because I didn't get around to them. So let's do those, or some of them. Lee from Oakville had asked, as the Jays evaluate a long-term commitment for Vladdy, have you seen any aging curves for players that have Vladdy's body type? I mean, this is an impossible thing because you can't really quantify a body type. Like, you could do BMI, but like Tyler O'Neill would come out as like obese on a BMI because he's so thick in the good way. You can't really do this. You can look for specific examples. You can look at maybe a Prince Fielder who fell off pretty early, but Prince Fielder also fell off in part because of continued neck injuries that require multiple surgeries. David Ortiz is maybe the higher end of that quote-unquote body type, and he peaked late into his career. Like, at this age, he was getting DFA'd still and found that much later in his career. So it's going to go all over the place. Like, I don't know, a guy like John Kruk played until he was like 34 and was pretty good until he was like 32, if I'm remembering correctly. It's also worth noting that, like, body type, you know, what we can see visually is a very imperfect measure of where a player is at athletically and health-wise and things like that. I understand what you're saying. I think there is a defensive component to that where, what is his position? Does he end up more of a full-time DH? That kind of thing. Those are relevant. David Ortiz is kind of the high-water data point of like, yeah, this can last if you're a hitter or you take care of the hitter side thing. So, yeah, relevant, but a little tough to, empirically study, we'll say. Nick from Toronto had asked, Alan Rhodes is absolutely tearing the cover off the ball in Buffalo. I've heard the Jays are apprehensive to call him up given lack of playing time. Do you think he has a chance to force his hand? I mean, he tried over the weekend. He had another three-hit game. He's red hot. Like I was saying with Julia, he is a guy that, like talk to him on the show, really believe in the statistical profile. Everything I hear from inside the organization and talking to scouts and stuff like that, I think he's going to be a guy. When it comes to this type of decision, when you're headed into an offseason where you're probably going to have a lot of roster churn, I understand that, hey, he doesn't need a 40-man spot until the end of next year. So that's not just about clearing a 40-man spot now. It's if you add him to the 40-man now and you call him up for September, you have to burn an option year on him if he doesn't make the team outright next year. And he's probably a guy that, similar to Barger and Horwitz and Arelvis this year, they don't want him up in a bench role to start next year. They probably want him playing every day still. He's only had a couple months at AAA here. It's not like he's in year two, year three of AAA. So I think they'll probably slower play it just for the sake of roster management. But he would be the headline item in terms of guys I'm most interested to see how they look in spring training. And if he could force his hand then you get to talking, because I think there's a real bat there, which is fun. It's the Jays have done a good job developing or finding and developing, a Horwitz, Wagner type guy. Josh Kasevich at AAA is another one of those guys. Good hit tool, but maybe not a ton of power upside with those guys. But Roden has a little bit more. He hasn't got into all of it yet, but given the doubles profile, the hard hit rates, things like that, more confident that he finds his way to power than some of those other guys. Gord said, wouldn't it be nice if there was somebody on base every so often when Vlad hits a home run? Yeah, it's surely frustrating, and this will be part of the Jays offseason, and what they're looking for is how to better build the lineup around Vlad. Now, part of that might be betting on a bounce back from Bo Bichette. Some of this will depend on, hey, do you think George Springer is a leadoff hitter again next year, or is he going to start the season, more back middle of the order, where he was for a chunk of this year, because he is now like a 300 OBP guy. If him and Bo are both low 300 OBP guys at the top of the order, that is tough for Vlad. You look at, say, Willy Adames in Milwaukee. He just hit his 13th three-run home run of the year. He's like coming in on Griffey's record for specifically three-run home runs. Nice to have guys ahead of you on base, certainly. And this is why, when we've talked about different leadoff options when George Springer went down and things like that, this is why I've tended to prefer an OBP guy in those spots. It's not necessarily like, first of all, the Jays don't have the high contact base stealing type. Like that guy's not in, like Ernie Clement would be the closest thing to that. But obviously Ernie's also a super aggressive chase outside the zone to find that contact type. There is not a Ricky Henderson, take six pitches, get on base, steal a base kind of guy here. So I would lean OBP in that spot. But yeah, that's going to be a focus of the offseason, not just how to add power to the order, but then how to structure those top five, top six, so Vlad is protected and insulated and also has guys on base. And also, what's the best spot to hit Vlad? You know, given he's a 300-plus hitter with OBP that pushes around 400, I think ideally if you add power to the lineup, he's hitting second next year in a similar way to how the Yankees hit Juan Soto second to make sure guys are on base for Aaron Judge. So lots to figure out there. Let's take a break. We'll do more text line later in the show as well, so you can keep texting us 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. Let's take a break. Let's get you set up for this Philly series. We'll talk to Adam Aronson of the Philly Voice, get you informed on Tyler Phillips. And yeah, we'll talk some Nick Castellanos. That's my guy. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A little Philly vibe for us to get us set up for this quick two-gamer. Chris Bassett against Tyler Phillips tonight at 7:07 down at Rogers Center. Bowden Francis against Christopher Sanchez at 3:07 tomorrow afternoon. A game that I'm bugging Elliot Friedman about. If you are a hockey fan, by the way, Elliot currently tweeting that it sounds like Leon Draisaitl and the Edmonton Oilers are getting close on an 8-year extension at an annual value that would be the highest in the NHL. So make sure you're keeping an eye on his Twitter for that, because we're not going to talk about it other than that and bugging Elliot to come on the show because he's a big Bowden Francis guy. All right, let's talk Phillies. Let's talk to our pal Adam Aronson of the Philly Voice. He's Sixers Adam, but today he is Phillies Adam. Adam, how we doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, man. Big series for the Phillies this weekend. They take 3 of 4 from the Braves. That's got to feel pretty good about their chances to hang on atop the NL East. Like, are you confident enough now that you're looking at, hey, Milwaukee and LA for buy purposes, and the division is more or less settled in your head?
Pretty much. Yeah, I mean, you know, 7 games up. I think the stat is that if the Phillies went 12-13 the rest of the way, the Braves would have to go 19-6. Which the Braves, I don't believe, have done over any 25-game stretch this year. Now, it is the Phillies, and they have authored some absolutely unbelievable September collapses in my lifetime, so nothing is impossible. But for the Braves to make up 7 games in 25 out of 25 with the teams not playing each other again, the season series is now over, does seem pretty difficult to imagine. Especially because the Philly schedule the rest of the way is light. They play Milwaukee for 3 games in a couple weeks, and that's their only series left against a team that's currently in postseason position. They're playing a couple more that are sort of vaguely in contention, but it's a light schedule the rest of the way. So I think they're probably more worried about, you know, getting a bye and focusing on what the Dodgers and Brewers are doing than they are the Braves or even the Mets, who are now a half game back of Atlanta thanks to the Phillies' help.
Yeah, and they've got those 2 series with the Mets, but we'll see. That's 10, 11 days from now. And like you said, it's a lighter stretch here. It's Toronto, who we would have thought this would be a marquee matchup in September. It is not. Apologies for that. And then, yeah, Miami and Tampa Bay. So this is a good stretch here for the Phillies to continue to stack. When you look at that bye situation, so they're half game up on the Brewers, a little behind the Dodgers, who have really rounded into form over the last couple weeks as well. How pivotal is that in your mind to get that bye, take the randomness of even if you're, you know, the home team and heavily favored in a wild card series, got to feel pretty big to be able to avoid that, right, in the new format?
Yeah, I think it's enormous, and of course it's not to say that teams can't you know, play in the 3-game series and go on and win the World Series. Obviously, I believe the Texas Rangers were in a 3-game series last year. You know, the Phillies were in the wild card each of the last 2 years, and if they had won one more game last year, they would have been back-to-back National League champions. But of course, just, you know, to avoid the putting it up to chance, you never know what can happen in a three-game series. I will say that I think it's safe to say the Phillies are uniquely well-built for that sort of structure because of their starting pitching. But again, you know, there are a lot of other teams with great starting pitching too, and you know, one bad start for a Zach Wheeler or an Aaron Nola or Ranger Suarez or Christopher Sanchez, all of a sudden you're in a really tough spot. So yeah, I mean, just to eliminate the chance that comes with a three-game series where, I mean, anybody can lose a three-game series to anybody, clearly. So, I mean, the Phillies lost three-game series to just about everybody for 2 months before a couple weeks ago. So yeah, I mean, to be able to just go straight to the NLDS, reset your pitching staff, perhaps most importantly as well, I can't really put a price on it. I think they should be doing whatever they can to get one of those buys.
Yeah, and that, look, that starting rotation is really good, but it looks really good in a 5 or 7 game series as well as in a 3 game series. So if you can avoid it and line them up, man, that rotation is something else. So they are second in the league in ERA as a rotation. They're third in the league in innings pitched as a rotation. If we use Fangraph's version of wins above replacement, they've been the best rotation in baseball. You know, obviously, like you said, it's the Phillies and it's randomness in the playoffs and things like that. But you're feeling like, is this the best and deepest rotation? I guess the Astros lately might have something to say about it, but I would think in the NL, like, the Phillies have to feel pretty confident that they've got the edge on the pitching side heading into just about any series.
Yeah, I think they do feel that way, and I think they're right to feel that way. And I think, you know, it's a testament to how impressive it is that, you know, they were, you know, you said third among rotations in ERA this year with 14 starts out of Taijuan Walker at a 6.5 ERA. And, you know, obviously when it boils down to it, you're using four, maybe even three guys when October rolls around for the Phillies. It'll certainly be four in their rotation. I just have trouble imagining any team feeling as good about four starting pitchers as the Phillies do about whatever order you want to put Wheeler, Nola, Ranger Suarez, and Christopher Sanchez in. These guys are just all, you know, with the exception of Suarez, who finally hit a sort of roadblock after looking like a Cy Young contender and has now made two starts since he came back from the injured list after missing about a month. You know, Wheeler has been, I think, the best pitcher in baseball since the Phillies signed him in 2020. He hasn't won a Cy Young yet. He lost out to Corbin Burnes in 21. He's probably going to lose out to Chris Sale this year, which is certainly understandable. Nola is as consistent as it gets. You know, rare guy who in today's day and age is going to give you 200-plus innings every year. And Christopher Sanchez, it's really an amazing story. This is a guy who sort of got called up last summer to make a few emergency spot starts, and a year later is in the All-Star game with a lengthy contract extension that buys out a few free agency years. This is a guy who threw really hard, but never knew where it was going. They dialed back his velocity, and his command became so much better, and he developed a changeup that has become maybe the best changeup in all of baseball. And he's just become a marvelous pitcher. And once he got the command down, they dialed the velocity back up, and the command was able to be sustained. So it's as someone who enjoys watching great pitching, you know, them having four starters this good is quite a treat. And, you know, two of them righties, two of them lefties, it gives them, you know, some versatility matchup wise with how they want to, you know, align their rotation heading into a postseason series. So, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things with the Phillies that have frustrated people here recently, and rightfully so. It's been a brutal couple months up until, you know, the last week and a half where they're really starting to turn things around. But they're just going to have the starting pitching advantage in just about any series they participate in, barring an injury over the next month. And, you know, again, it's another thing that you can't put a price on.
No, and I mean, you can try, and then Christopher Sanchez signs a what I would imagine is a going to look like a below market deal from the price you would have put on it anyway. And yeah, Sanchez is fascinating. I remember I did a breakdown on him on our pregame show, Blue Jay Central, early in the year, looking at that changeup, and it's just such a ground ball machine. You put a good defense behind him, and obviously ground balls insulate you a little better from mistakes than fly balls. That's pretty fun to see. And all these guys are locked up, right? Like Nola's got term, Wheeler's got term. You know, Taiwan Walker, for better or worse, has a couple years left on his. And then Suarez is, you know, has another year of arbitration. Christopher Sanchez now locked up, nice and affordable. This is a Phillies rotation that is locked in and stable. And Nola and Wheeler, it's incredible, really. Like they're kind of the NL version of the Blue Jays in that Barrios, Gausman, and Bassett post more than anyone in the American League over the last couple of years. Nola and Wheeler are first and third in innings pitched in all of baseball since 2018. It's pretty remarkable that level of consistency they've had there. Okay, so those are all the positives. What did you make of the move of Taiwan Walker to the bullpen as kind of the, hey, what are you going to do with the extra roster spot in September? Well, we're going to call Tyler Phillips back up. He's going to enter the rotation. Taiwan Walker is going to become a long man or mop-up man. What did you make of that switch out? Just time for Taiwan Walker, given how this season's gone?
I hate to say it so bluntly, but frankly, there's no indication from anything in a statistical profile or anything from watching Taiwan Walker that would lead you to believe he's a major league caliber pitcher anymore. It's been that bad. You know, we're talking about a 6.5 ERA, a WHIP close to 1.7. The FIP is 6.31. He's not striking anybody out. He's walking guys more than he has. It's a lot of hard contact. His last start, no strikeouts in six innings. To his credit, he did go to Phillies manager Rob Thompson seemingly and say, like, we have a four-game series against the Braves starting tomorrow that we have to win. Like, let me wear this and keep the bullpen fresh and win an extra two innings. And I think everybody around the team sort of appreciated that. But he's just not a good enough pitcher to start every fifth day on a team that wants to win the World Series, even for, you know, a few spot starts in September. You know, one Taiwan Walker start that where he blows up versus a start where, you know, Tyler Phillips or Colby Howard has a decent outing could be the difference between whether you have a bye or you're playing a three game series on October 1st. So I think it had to be done, and I don't think it's due to a lack of work ethic on Walker's part, and the Phillies have asserted he's done everything he can, but the velocity on his fastball is not there, and then it's hard for him to separate his splitter, which is sort of his go-to pitch, and it's not getting any swings and misses. It's been rough to watch. I have a hard time imagining him being on the Phillies active roster at any point next year, but I think they decided, you know, to kick the can down the road as far as deciding how much money they're going to have to eat on Walker. And you know, with the expanded roster spot, they didn't have an obvious candidate who could come in and strengthen the bullpen anyways. So, you know, we'll make him a sort of mop up man, like you said.
Yeah. And look, there's some value to that in a game that gets away from you. You know, hey, you're down 10-0 and you need someone to cover 2-3 innings without burning the top four in that bullpen. There's a little bit of value in that, but not $36 million over the next 2 years value right in that. It's sad to see, because this is a Blue Jays legend we're talking about. Those 26 innings in 2020 were incredible. Okay, about that bullpen, Adam. They went out, they got Carlos Estevez, they traded away Sir Anthony Dominguez and Gregory Soto. By the way, before I get into the Philly side, have you enjoyed watching the Orioles go through the Sir Anthony Dominguez experience so far?
I've enjoyed watching the Orioles go through the experience of seemingly every former Phillies reliever of the last few years. Their bullpen now has Craig Kimbrel, Sir Anthony Dominguez, and Gregory Soto. The Soto experience has been brutal there. I think he gave up like 9 earned runs in his first inning of work there. His ERA with the Orioles, I think, is like close to 7.5. Kimbrel has been very hit or miss, as he often is. And I felt for Sir Anthony, because this is a guy who he was one of the, like, I think two or three longest tenured Phillies at this point. A guy who came up and as a rookie, he had this rapid rise through the minors out of nowhere and weeks later was the team's closer and is throwing 100 and you know, they're using him in four out save situations every night. And then he has Tommy John and he has to work. He misses a year. He come in 2021, he came back for game 162 to pitch. And then 22 were sort of struggling. And then in October, all of a sudden was unhittable and is just striking out everybody and helped carry their bullpen. And it just hasn't really clicked since. It's been a little better for him in Baltimore, though everybody seemingly is sort of underqualified for their role in that bullpen right now. But the Phillies bullpen is in a good spot.
Yeah.
It's not in the best spot. I think, you know, I my sort of take heading into the trade deadline was that they should add at least one, if not two more relievers than they currently have in terms of guys who could theoretically be trusted. And they didn't add any. They swapped effectively Sir Anthony for Estevez. They swapped Gregory Soto for Tanner Banks. And both of those clearly were upgrades. And, you know, the top four of this bullpen, oof, you could say, are really good. But beyond that, you know, the depth of it is a little shaky. What happens if, you know, they have a few guys unavailable in a playoff game and they need to go to someone in the fourth or fifth inning? I don't know who they call upon in that situation. But it's a good bullpen, and Jeff Hoffman and Matt Strom are the biggest reasons why. They've just both been outstanding. Strom, lefty, who gets righties out. They're both striking guys out. Neither of them are walking a ton. Jeff Hoffman went from, you know, a flyer minor league deal last year to this year being, you know, one of the best right-handed relievers in all of baseball and probably set for a pretty significant payday in free agency after this season. So he signed a minor league deal with the team, and the story is he impressed them enough to give him a major league audition, not because of what he was doing in AAA Lehigh Valley, but because the Phillies did not want Bryce Harper to have to go on a minor league rehab assignment when he was recovering from Tommy John. So they brought a few AAA pitchers to Philly to pitch to Bryce Harper in live BP. And Jeff Hoffman was just blowing stuff by him. And Bryce was like, oh my God, this guy is nasty. And now a year and change later, you know, he's one of the best relievers in baseball. And it's really a remarkable story. But yeah, I mean, the depth of the bullpen is problematic, but with Hoffman and Strom there and rookie Orion Kerkering has been outstanding as well. He's got this unbelievable slider that he throws. The Phillies hope that Jose Alvarado, who just got activated off the restricted list, he was dealing with a family matter. They feel good about their bullpen, seemingly. I certainly feel good about the back end of their bullpen. I wish I had a little more trust in some of the guys who might come in the middle innings, but, you know, such is life, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, show me the team that trusts eight or nine bullpen guys. I don't think they're
right.
If your back four is as good as any bullpen I've seen since like the 2015 Royals, who won a World Series off of having just the good three innings to close a game. Last Phillies question for you. I know this is something you're passionate about. Why is Austin Hayes still playing every day against righties?
I wish I could tell you that when the Phillies traded Sir Anthony Dominguez and Christian Pache for him, it's like, okay, great. They traded like a reliever who they weren't going to use in high leverage spots and an outfielder who was going to get DFA'd for someone who hits lefties. He'll be a platoon partner for Brandon Marsh in left field. It'll be great. And the Phillies said, no, he's an everyday player. When he gets everyday opportunities, he'll hit both pitching. And it has not happened. They're still trying to make it work. I don't think it will, frankly. Just the numbers against right-handed pitching have not been there for him over the last few years. I suppose crazier things have happened, but I think their better alignment now is with Johan Rojas in center field, who also cannot hit righties, but is, you know, maybe a true 80 grade level defensive center fielder. It also slides Brandon Marsh from center to left, where he's outstanding and could be a Gold Glove caliber left fielder. I don't entirely understand it beyond, you know, sort of sticking to their preconceived notions about Hayes when they made the trade. And I understand, you know, having conviction in a guy, and I'm sure they did all the requisite scouting and whatnot. But from everything I've seen, it's hard to imagine why he should be in a lineup against a tough righty in October. But, you know, maybe it's on their radar, and if it still doesn't work in the near future, they'll make a change. But, you know, they maintain that Austin Hayes is an everyday caliber player.
Well, he'll see a couple of righties in this series, so we'll see how that goes for him. Okay, Adam, you are Sixers Adam in addition to being Phillies Adam for us today. Sixers question before I let you go here. And as much as I would love to use this one Sixers question on Jeff Doughton Jr., who is an NBA player and is my guy,
he is.
I got to ask you about Yabu instead. You guys get Gershon Yabusele. He pays out a huge buyout with Real Madrid coming off that Olympic performance. How excited are you to have Dancing Bear back in the NBA and on that 76ers team you cover?
Yeah, it should be fun. I think everybody was sort of thinking when they saw the dunk on LeBron and the MVP chance and Paris and everything, like this would be fun. This would be a cool story if he were back into the league. And I didn't know if it was going to be with the Sixers or not. I was somewhat surprised that he took a minimum deal just because of that buyout situation that you mentioned with Real Madrid. But he has made it abundantly clear he did with, figuring out that buyout and signing a minimum deal here. I think Jake Fisher of Yahoo Sports reported that he might be playing for more like $500,000 when factoring in the buyout, which like the minimum contract is about $2.1 million. Between that, everything he said when he met with a few of us in the media last week at the Sixers facility in New Jersey, and it was just very clear from him, like, my goal has been to get back into the NBA because, he's betting on himself. He feels all he needed was a chance to be on an NBA roster, and by the end of that season, it will be abundantly clear to everybody that he's an NBA caliber player. The Sixers have theoretically a hole at power forward. They could use someone with some muscle, with some strength, who can rebound. And of course, it always helps if you can step out and knock down a three, and he's shown he can do that during his international career. Looking forward to watching Yabusele. I got to be honest, my money was on a Kyle Lowry question, but I'm pleasantly surprised by the Yabu shout.
No, I mean, coming off the Olympics, we got to get it in there. We'll do more 76ers talk, a couple weeks from now when we ramp up for Raptors season here. Adam, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Keep up all the great work on both sports.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Adam Aronson, Sixers Adam on Twitter. I have the Philly voice covering the 76ers and this Philadelphia Phillies team. We'll continue to set this series up over the course of our second hour here. We're also going to talk to Jake Mintz of Cespedes Family Barbecue and Yahoo Sports, Travis Sochik of The Score. We got a little Jays promotional stuff to do later in the show as well. And we'll set you up for Tyler Phillips against Chris Bassett. Tyler Phillips, who... not a great book on him, but the sweeper looks plus-plus. So we'll see how that plays today, how the Jays handle it. We'll also sprinkle in some more of your text to 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. After the break, Jake Mintz of Yahoo Sports and Cespedes Family Barbecue as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Busy weekend around baseball. Yeah, calling it the weekend, I guess. Yeah. It was a long weekend in the U.S. too, I think. They get Labor Day. They have unions. They deserve days off. Jake Mintz deserves days off. He's getting married this week, but he's still coming on to join us regardless. Man, this level of commitment to the team, I love to see it, Jake. Thanks for taking the time out.
You know, if you love what you do, it's not work. And I love getting married, or at least I think I'm going to.
Yeah, it's, hey. If you love it enough, only do it once, I guess, is the way you go with that one. Okay, Jake Mintz of Yahoo Sports, of the Barbiecast, of Cespedes Family Barbecue, of course. Man, busy weekend. Let's start in the NL East because the Phillies are here in Toronto now. They take 3 of 4 from the Braves. We ready to call it? NL East is a wrap at a 7-game gap here with 22, 23 to go.
It's never over till it's over, but it was an enormous weekend for the Phillies. The Braves came into the weekend 5 games back in the division with a 4-game set. And I don't need to explain math to people, but they could have left with a pretty small gap to make up the difference. And instead, the Phillies take 3 of 4, and now that lead is at 7 games. And the Braves really could have won all four of those ball games. They were leading in game one, 4-0 in the middle innings. Their bullpen blew it. Two-run homer from Nick Castellanos gave the Phillies a lead in that one. They win game two. Game three, Zach Wheeler shuts them out. And then in game four, it goes 11 innings. I think the Braves should be more preoccupied with the Mets being a half game behind them and not the Phillies being seven games in front of them.
Yeah, it was a bit of a rough series for Brian Snicker. And obviously, look, the story of the Braves season is they've had so many injuries, but there has to be an element of, like, get out of your own way here. Like, it does seem like they've tripped up a little bit in addition to all of the injuries they've dealt with. Is that fair, do you think?
Yeah, yes and no. I think the injuries have been so overwhelming that it exposes other elements of the team that maybe aren't perfect. And when you have Ronald Acuna and Spencer Strider and Ozzie Albies and Austin Riley, all of whom are out, all of whom are all-star level players, it just, you see, you can pick apart a lot more stuff, right? And I think that Brian Snitker, there were a couple moves he probably regrets from the weekend that was, but I don't think that the managerial decision-making has really is the biggest factor in the deficit that they face. I mean, this is a team that's won six straight division titles. They're not going to win it this year, and that's because the best player in the National League last year, who won the MVP, Ronald Acuna Jr., and a guy who many people picked to win the NL Cy Young this year, Spencer Strider, both have not played a baseball game since May. It's really, I wish it was more interesting, if that makes sense.
No, but like, and it's...
The Braves apart more, but that really is the whole thing.
Yeah, and there's a cascading effect to you lose Acuna and then Riley and then Albies, and suddenly, like, guys aren't hitting one spot up in the order. They're in three spots up in the order and things. And then, like, you know, when you get into bullpen management, and I didn't think Snicker had the best weekend, but we're also talking about these are one-run leads or tie games that if you had your full lineup might be three-run leads or one-run leads.
Yeah.
You know, you're managing it a little differently. This is the hand the Braves are dealt with here, though, and the Mets are only a half game back now. The Mets are kind of like the idiot choice, I'll say, as an idiot who's rooting for the Mets. Maybe the fun first choice is a better way to put it. What do you make of that part of the race here? I guess Cubs have gotten themselves at the periphery of it as well.
Yeah, the thing with the Mets is it's a win-win for the neutrals, because when the Mets are in it, the rest of us get to watch Mets fans watch the Mets. And that is the most entertaining thing in the entire world. They're half game back. Even now, if you look at their roster compared to the Braves, there's still a gap. I would still take Atlanta's group. The Mets pitching has been a lot better over the last couple of months. Sean Manaea in particular has been outstanding for them. Do they have enough time to do it? I don't know. If you made me choose, I'd still take the Braves. I think the quality of their starting rotation is just too overwhelming. And I would be intimidated by Atlanta if I had to face them in a postseason series, just because they can roll out Chris Sale, who's going to win the NL Cy Young, Max Fried, who's pitched 1,000 times in October, Reynaldo Lopez, who has an ERA around 2, and then Spencer Schwellenbach, who shut down the Phillies for the better part of six innings over the weekend. And the Mets just don't have that same sort of imposing dynamic in the rotation. That being said, like, Francisco Lindor is a game changer. Pete Alonso has been a lot better. It's just, I find it difficult to not pick the Braves. I will pick the Braves until they prove me wrong, is I guess how I would say it.
Yeah, it's the champion's advantage, right? Like, you're the champion until you're not the champion anymore. A tie goes to the champion. That can't lose the title on a disqualification. All that kind of stuff. Okay, I want to come back to Francisco Lindor in a second when we talk Shohei, but last one for you on this NL East. When you look at, this is something I'm still kind of mentally adjusting to in the three wildcard era, which is that in addition to the third wildcard, there is a huge value, I think, on, you know, getting one of those top two seeds in your league so that you get the bye and you don't have to deal with a best two out of three. If you are the Phillies and the Brewers and the Dodgers and it's that close, how pivotal do you think it is to get that bye versus, hey, you've got home field and you're the better team in a best of three? I'd rather just punch my way through, and I would put a lot on the line this last month to do that.
So I think multiple things could be true. We look at last season where two wildcard teams ended up playing in the World Series. Two wildcard teams that played that first round on the road. Texas went to Tampa. Arizona went to Milwaukee. Both of those teams won. That allowed them to build up a level of momentum so that they kind of rolled in hot into that next round. That's great. That might be true. The math says you take the free wins.
100% chance of moving on.
Yes. That's that simple, right? And I think it will be an interesting thing to follow. I would expect the Dodgers to secure that first bye. I think they're going to start pulling away here. The Phillies and the Brewers will battle it out for that second spot, and the difference is big, especially based on what I just talked about, right? If you get the three seed, there's a strong chance you have to face the Braves in the first round. And that pitching staff, hey, congrats, you made the playoffs. Your very first game is against Chris Sale, right?
Yep.
That, to me, is way worse than the idea of not having momentum, right?
Yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense, right? And I get it. The momentum factor, you know, I've talked to some players who maybe don't want to sit for 4 or 5 days. It's like a little tough to stay fresh. Sure.
Sure.
That first game in the second round might be a tough one for you. You know what's tougher? And we experienced this very, very intimately the last couple of years here, not getting to play in that game whatsoever. I'd rather be at a slight disadvantage in game one of the second round than not be there at all, which is, you know, at best, we're talking what, like a 55-45 proposition, probably the best possible odds you could have in a best two or three, and sure, that's probably high.
Yeah, absolutely. And remember, if you are the team that has the bye, in game one of the DS, you get to face the other team's third or fourth pitcher,
yeah,
presumably, right? That's another huge advantage. We can't just look at the recent sample size and lean on that and say, oh, well, last year this happened, so it's a good thing to not have the bye. That's just not true. And so I do think it'll be a big narrative as we head down the stretch, to be honest with you, in both leagues.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we'll see in the American League. Like, it seems like neither team in the AL East wants to win that division lately. Sticking with the NL just for a second longer, though, you mentioned the Dodgers. You think they're going to pull away here. Shohei now at 44 home runs at 46 stolen bases. 50-50 seems pretty likely. Man, you don't have a vote for NL MVP, do you?
I do not.
So you're allowed to talk about
it. I am part
of
the New York chapter, so I don't have a vote this year.
Okay. Okay. So how are you feeling about it? That you're allowed to talk about it then. Shohei, Lindor, at this point, we're headed for 50-50 and maybe hitting 300, something that's never been done before. And then Lindor is the best player and best all-around player on a team that might sneak into the playoffs here. How are you feeling about it?
It's Shohei. I don't want to give it to a DH. I think the wear and tear of playing defense really is a big deal. Literally, like, imagine 2 hours a day, you have to go stand in the sun. Like, that is exhausting every single day. And I think the players that are able to play a premium position like shortstop and provide offensive value like Lindor deserve a lot of praise. That being said, what Ohtani's done is just simply overwhelming. I love the narrative heft of, oh, I can't pitch this year. Let me focus all that energy on stealing a boatload of bases.
It's ridiculous. He's going to steal 50 bases. It's like the last time someone came top two in home runs and stolen bases in the same year was like, I think you have to go back to like Ty Cobb or something like that. Yeah. Someone who, you know, played against a half a league and stuff. It's ridiculous. Yeah, it's ludicrous.
Not the same thing. And I think it is important to recognize that it is easier to steal bases now with the new rules than it was 4 years ago. That does not mean it's not impressive.
Yeah, because it's easier for everyone. It applies to everyone. And you're still, if you're in first or second, that's the same advantage everyone has. Yes. Trey Turner could go out there and steal those two.
Absolutely. I do think that the 40-40 threshold, we will need to kind of adjust our brains to a new number for steals. Jose Ramirez is at 34-34 right now. Like, it is simply easier to do. It is still outrageous that a guy who, by the way, throws 98 has going to get to 50 steals, 50 homers.
And is like 6'4", 215. Like, he's a huge dude, too. It's pretty remarkable. Okay, so obviously the Dodgers have plenty going on the hitter side. Shohei Ohtani, Mookie Betts, Freddie Freeman, our old friend Teoscar Hernandez, Gavin Lux is back to life. They have enough on that side. The question every year for the last like 11 years, are the Dodgers going to have enough pitching in the playoffs? Obviously a lot of injuries there. How are you feeling about that aspect of it? The Dodgers' ability to go on a little bit of run here. Jack Flaherty, Walker Buehler just back. And then you get into like Bobby Miller, Gavin Stone, River Ryan territory.
I do not feel good. about the Dodgers pitching. I think, particularly when you compare it to some of the other teams in the National League, I just prefer what the Phillies have in the rotation or what the Braves have. I think I would take the Dodgers over the Brewers' mishmash of pitchers who have actually been pretty good, surprisingly. But it's just these injuries are so devastating for Los Angeles. I don't know who's going to start. We heard that they are, quote, hopeful that Tyler Glasnow will be available. Hopeful. Hopeful does not make me feel hopeful. I'll tell you that, right? So I think that they can rely on Jack Flaherty. And I think Gavin Stone, Walker Buehler and Bobby Miller have had a bumpy year. I know they're both back pitching now. But am I confident in them? No. Yoshinobu Yamamoto is set to return at some point. Am I confident in him? No. Clayton Kershaw at this point? No. So I just, if you're asking me if I feel good, absolutely not. That being said, when you're rolling out like Ohtani, Betts, Freeman, Hernandez, Lux, Will Smith, Max Muncy in your top seven of the lineup, you can just bludgeon anyone into dust on any given day of the week.
I mean, look at yesterday's game, right? Like they play the number one offensive baseball in the Arizona Diamondbacks and they don't pitch particularly well. I know Anthony Bonda got out of some trouble there, but like, yeah, it's just, okay, we could just win a game 11-6. We'll just tack on insurance runs until it's impossible for you to come back. And that's a good Diamondbacks team.
Absolutely. Now, again, my concern is if you get into an NLCS and you're facing Wheeler, Nola, Ranger Suarez, like that doesn't always work, right? And we've seen that happen to the Dodgers so many times in October where the offense looks really good and an offense can go cold in a short stretch. And if your pitching isn't dominant, you can fall out of the autumn baseball extravaganza very easily, very quickly.
Yeah, it's tough. And that's why for the Dodgers, more than any of those NL teams, I think that that buy is going to be a premium position. They're going to whip around a couple quicker ones for you. On the American League side, you surprised no Jason Dominguez call up for the Yankees here as rosters expand?
I am surprised. I think he makes them a better team for sure right now if he's playing. I think that leaving him down to give him every day at bats is defensible because if you want him to be a part of your team in October, I understand not wanting to play him 2 days a week. I think Yankees fans think that if you just put him in the big leagues, he's going to hit 300 with 30 bombs right away. We know that's not how it works. We've been watching Anthony Volpe not get to that immediately. And so I think that a little bit of perspective is necessary. That being said, Verdugo has just been so rough on offense that I can't feel confident about it.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And you under like I think the explanation you just gave makes a little bit more sense than the, oh, well, the service time in the event he wins the 2025 Rookie of the Year and then you get the comp pick and stuff. I think that's a little few too many layers. Okay, another quick one for you, because you are, as far as I can see, the other charter member of Spencer Arrighetti Hive. You wrote about this for Yahoo Sports recently. Astros have too many starters now?
Dude, he's freaking nails. Arrighetti is so good. The Astros are going to have a fascinating choice, people. Are they going to give a postseason start to Justin Verlander? Yes, that is a real sentence I said out loud with my mouth in the year 2024. But they have six starters, and I think five of them are better than Justin Verlander right now. Whew. Arrighetti has been outstanding for 2 months. Hunter Brown has been outstanding for 3 months. Framber Valdez is the only one where it's like stone cold lock to start a game. And then Ronel Blanco has been a breakout. And they traded for Kikuchi from you folks at the deadline, and he's been amazing. And look, I think they will end up giving Verlander a start. I do. I think that he started, 37 postseason games in his career. He's going to be a Hall of Famer. You give him the ball. And if he's bad, you take him out early. But is he one of the best four? I don't know.
It's tough because you also, like, the Astros, I mean, they could close the gap between now and the end of September, but the way it looks right now is they'd be headed for a wild card series, and you can't, I mean, there's no room for error. There's no room to be like, hey, Justin Verlander, you're 41, here's the gold watch start in a wild card game, and then it derails your playoff chances. It's too tough there, and you're right, Kikuchi's been amazing for them. I wonder, do you think Arrighetti's stuff could play in the bullpen more than some of those other guys, just given the amount of swing and miss there?
I think it could, but his propensity for walks would give me worries. You know, that is his bugaboo. Even in the game where he carried the no-hitter into the eighth inning, he had two separate instances where he walked back-to-back hitters. And that's just a little risky to bring that type of player out of the bullpen.
All right, last one for you before I let you go and get on with wedding week, Jake. The Chicago White Sox are 31 and 108. They have lost 11 games in a row for, I believe, the third time this year. They have been outscored by more than 300 runs. Under the caveat that, like, you had to choose guys on 40-man rosters, you couldn't just, like, fill the roster with single A. Do you think you could create a team that performs worse than this in a video game, like Out of the Park Baseball or MLB The Show or anything like that?
You mean like selecting minor leaguers or?
Well, no, the caveat would be they've got to be like at least like 40 man caliber. You can't just like fill the team with single A guys.
Oh,
but like at least reasonably close major leaguers.
Yeah, I can make a worse team than this.
Okay.
Like this is a really bad team. Don't get me wrong, but they stink. There's no way around. This is a bad ball club. Like, yikes. That being said, I think if you gave me that task, I could complete it.
Okay. I believe in you. You could take Garrett Crochet out is like the easy move. It's like, okay, you don't have 132 innings of pretty good play there. I don't even know where you'd start chopping away. Like they started a lineup the other day of everyday guys and not a single person had a 700 OPS.
Yeah, it's not exactly a good baseball team. That is certainly true. I had this experience of, you know, as someone who cares about the Baltimore Orioles, watching the Orioles play the White Sox yesterday, and the White Sox go up two runs in the first inning. And I'm like, this is the sky is falling. Playing the White Sox is actually a lose-lose scenario because if your team beats the White Sox, there's no joy. And if they lose to them, it's a complete calamity.
Yeah, it's and this is James Fegan on Sox Machine has been kind of tracking this of like, what is the most, like of the 31 White Sox wins, what is the one that drove the opposing fan base most insane? It's nice at least though, that after this Orioles series, and then they have the Guardians next week, at least they're not going to affect any playoff races anymore. They got like Oakland, the Angels and the Tigers. They're at least going to stop messing this stuff up.
Sounds like a lot of wins in there to me.
Yeah. Yeah. At least three or four wins. Jake, thanks so much for taking the time out in a busy week, man. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thank you, folks.
Jake Mintz of Yahoo Sports, Cespedes Family Barbecue, the Barbacast over at Yahoo Sports. And congrats to him later this week as well. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Travis Sochik of The Score, talk to you a little bit about what the Jays have coming up from a in-arena or in-stadium and promotional standpoint in September. We'll get you ready for Tyler Phillips against Chris Bassitt. We'll take a couple of your texts to 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. Actually, let's do one of those right now. George in Toronto had asked, do you know if Blue Jays go through longer slumps than players on other teams, that they have more hitting coaches than other teams? As far as like longer slumps, that would be really, it's a tough thing to quantify. You have to get into like hitter type as well, because certain player profiles are more prone to slumping than, you know, generally. I would say the Jays longer slumps, probably yes this year. The Springer and Bo ones, Varsho's midseason, those extended a little long. But I do wonder if we looked at other teams, like this Phillies team, like Trey Turner's been in a slump for like a month. And I'm sure for Phillies fans, it feels like the end of the world. You know, JT Realmuto and Nick Castellanos have just got their season lines back to league average with hot August. I think probably this is one of those things that feels a little more extreme when you're in it and watching the team every day. As for the hitting coaches thing, I think it's pretty standard at this point for teams to have 3-4 hitting coaches. You know, a strategy guy, you know, you think about the amount of work you would want 13 players to do before a game. That can't just be one or two hitting coaches. You need a couple from a cage perspective, a video perspective, things like that. I think 3 or 4, maybe even 5 is probably pretty standard at this point. Chris in Regina had asked, this was last week, numerous times for Bowden Francis, the catcher raised his glove like he wanted a high pitch, and then the pitch was either right down the pipe or bottom of the zone. Was that a ploy or Francis missing his spots? I think probably a mix of both. It's a weird thing where like they've studied like how close pitchers actually get to their catcher's targets, and it's not particularly close. Like on league average, it's guys aren't that accurate toward the catcher's target. Now, part of that is probably the catcher is setting up in a way that you don't want to give something away to a base runner or a base coach or even the hitter if he can peek out of his eye. Although, as I understand it, it is very, very difficult to peek out of the side of your eye and then get your eye back on the pitcher, and all that stuff stays in chain and you don't get one blown by you while you're trying to cheat like that. I think it's probably a combo of both of those things. I think with a guy like Bowden Francis, who has a ride fastball and a splitter who's going to try to play off of that, you're going to want your catcher moving around similarly to Gosman. Like, I think ideally you set up bottom of the zone and then the catcher's, you know, going up for the ride fastball or going down for the splitter. And if you're kind of located in that lower third as a target, that's the hardest area for the hitter to pick up. And that's, you know, why Gosman has had some success peppering the fastball low in the zone. At times, if it's a team like the Twins that is particularly lay off the splitter low, lay off the splitter low, lay off the splitter low, I think there's probably a bit case by case and then probably a bit of both things going on. Sometimes you're going to miss a spot. If there is a criticism of Bowden Francis over this hot stretch, it's that he has gotten away with, you know, the odd fastball that catches too much of the plate. But that's part of the benefit of having a deceptive approach angle and having that kind of ride on it. So we'll see. We'll see tomorrow how that looks. Let's take a break. Let's check in on the Guardians. Let's check in on the 2025 free agent class and see where this Jays team could build with Travis Sochik of The Score. Next, as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Fresh views on everything in the National Football League. It's the Fan Checkdown with Matt Marchese and Donovan Bennett. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. We are headed for a fun battle between the Jays and the Phillies. The Phillies, an okay defensive team overall, average to slightly above average, depending on which defensive metrics you look at. However, Nick Castellanos, Kyle Schwarber, and Trey Turner, if you look at the last two seasons, all in the bottom three in defensive runs saved. Meanwhile, the Jays have Dalton Varsho, who is by far at the absolute top of that list. 54 defensive runs saved over the last 2 years. Thanks to Chris Black for that stat. Let's check in on the Guardians before we talk a little bit more Blue Jays with Travis Sochik of The Score. Travis, good morning, man. How are we doing?
Doing well. Great to be back with you.
How excited are you that Kyle Manzardo is not only back, but homering for the Cleveland Guardians?
Yeah, I've been a pretty vocal, at least on social media, fan of Manzardo's game, and it was he, like so many young players, you know, in his first exposure to major leagues, really struggled. I did think his plate appearances were getting better in his first exposure a couple months back before he was sent down to AAA. But, yeah, good to see him. I mean, the Guardians really need his bat to get going. Mm-hmm. They need to lengthen their lineup a little bit. And, he homered twice on Sunday. And, yeah, this is a top 100, top 50 prospect by some accounts for a lot of reasons. And there's that the bat had a 60, 65 grade for some scouts. And I think he's got power. Not that he'll ever be a 40 home run guy, but I do think given his bat to ball skills and ability to get the ball in the air to the pool side, he's got plenty of home run potential too, especially I don't know if you're familiar with how Progressive Field is playing this year. But since they did the renovation and opened up some of the third deck, mm-hmm. the ballpark factors have changed because there seems to be some airflow, a wind tunnel effect out to right field. So anytime the Guardians get a little promising left-handed bat, we might want to bump up their power projections by a few home runs.
Yeah, hey, Josh Naylor's hit 29. Jose Ramirez is going to try to follow Shohei into 40-40 territory. Not that those guys don't have power anyway, but it certainly helps a little bit. So this is a Cleveland team. They had dropped three in a row to Kansas City. They're starting to look a little dicey in the AL Central, but then they beat Kansas City at the end of that series. They take two of three against Pittsburgh. They beat Kansas City again yesterday. 3.5 up on Minnesota, 4.5 up on Kansas City. How confident should the Guardians be in that AL Central race right now with 24 games to go, including three against the White Sox, who they never seem to beat?
Yeah, the AL Central is pretty interesting right now. We have four teams above 500 and the White Sox, who might take the total division under 500 in the aggregate. Every time the Guardians look like they're really struggling, they've turned things around and righted themselves. They haven't had too many extended slumps this year. I think having an elite bullpen helps, having Jose Ramirez helps. I think it's going to be a very competitive finish. One big thing in their favor is starting on September 12th, they only play three more games on the road in that span. So they have a ton of home games to finish the season. And they've been very good at home. I mean, like most teams, you perform better at home for a variety of reasons. But Guardians have been very good at Progressive Field, and they have one of the heaviest remaining home slates, which works in their favor. So, you know, we're going to have a potentially great AL Central finish, and also wild card implications too. So we don't always see this in the AL Central, and so we don't always see a lot of meaningful September baseball in this division. But this year's going to be different. It's going to be good theater down the stretch.
Yeah, I mean, how much do you think there's sticking power to that too? Because obviously the AL East, you know, the Orioles have built up this huge cache of prospects. The Rays are the Rays. The Red Sox and Yankees and Jays to some extent can spend near the top of the league. But Cleveland and Minnesota are already good and both have top five farm systems. Kansas City took a big step forward this year and has, you know, what looks like is going to be a perennial MVP candidate to build around. And the Tigers are, you know, not there yet, but going to hang around. Like, do you think we're headed toward a four-fifths era of the Central being pretty competitive year over year? Or is this kind of more of a blip and we'll settle back into that being the division where, hey, there are a lot of teams around 85 wins?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I do think some of these baseball operation groups are improved in the AL Central in recent years. Tigers, I think the Royals, of some of their offseason acquisitions were huge, like Seth Lugo. I think Wood Jr. is an amazing player. I think that 2019 draft class for them with Pasquantino and Michael Massey. I know Pasquantino's out now, but they seem to have, their process seems to be improved in some way. So I do think, you know, the Guardians have been very consistent for a long time, very good scouting development team. Twins have been very good under Dirk Falvey. So I do think the bar has been raised on a lot of the development scouting operations, and we're starting to see that. And it's going to be, I mean, for so many years, it was, you know, there was maybe one playoff competitive team or two, and then the rest of the division was so poor. But I do think it's going to be a more competitive neighborhood in the coming years, which, you know, given that where the AL East usually is, and I don't see that changing, the AL in general is going to be a tougher landscape in which to compete.
Yeah, it kind of sucks. And if you are a team that's expensive and has a poor farm and hasn't been good at the major league level, you may be in trouble. Before we get to that team, though, I just wanted to touch on a tremendous Bobby Witt Jr. feature you wrote last week for The Score. Man, what I know this is kind of the heart of the piece, but for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, not only is this one of the best under 25 seasons we've ever seen, but what has allowed everything to click for him so quickly in your estimation and from talking to the people you spoke to for that piece?
Yeah, I was hoping there'd be some amazing new training regimen or something something like that explain it, but it really, as Witt said, it's just, I'm just making the game as simple as possible. And I couldn't extract any great revelation from him, but just speaking with the hitting coaches there and some of his teammates, he's just becoming better at zeroing in on the pitches he can do damage to. And some of that is, the Royals have tried to make practice more game-like a bunch of teams. They have their hitting coach, Alex Umwalt, is actually a former minor league pitcher. So he will get out there. They don't just use the high velocity and spin machines and the batting cages we don't see like so many teams do now to make practice more game-like. But last year when Witt was struggling a little bit, Umwalt went out there and was throwing just at the base of the mound, so maybe 50 feet from home plate, and he was just letting it rip, trying to strike Witt Jr. out. And he wanted him to see a live arm, not just a machine. And there's got to be benefits to that. So they started that practice, just trying to hone his swing decisions and, you know, just offer it. As Umwalt says, the only thing you can really control as a batter is, you know, what pitches are you swinging at? And you want to be swinging at the ones you can do damage against. And, you know, there's no doubting Witt Jr.'s, you know, physical gifts. They're off the charts. But what we've seen is, and I think it really shows up, and not to get too nerdy, but his exit velocity on pitches in the heart of the strike zone as defined by baseball savants. So not just in the strike zone, but really in the heart of it. The center cut pitches, his exit velo has gone up from 95 miles an hour to almost 99 miles an hour this year. So he is just zeroing in on pitches he can damage, being more selective. And, you know, he's also cut down the strikeout rate, which is already below the major league average. So he's just this perfect offensive force right now. He's doing everything well. And in addition to his well above average glove and base running, he's one of the rare five-tool players in the game. And maybe it's just as simple as this great, phenomenal talent on a natural aging curve. And we saw him break out really in the second half of last year, and he's carried that over. And, you know, looking at where this season ranks among the all-time greats, I don't have that chart in front of me, but it's like the 12th best under 25 season ever, and we still have a month to play. And most all of the names on that list are Hall of Famers. So this is really a special player. I think more than anything, getting those game reps, getting better practice reps, and having the natural gifts.
Yeah, I'd understand if a guy could like fake or like, you know, variance or outlier his way to like a 4-win season. Can't do that for a 10-win season, which is what Bobby Witt Jr. is on the way to here. Okay, so from a team that is making one of the single largest single season turnarounds in league history to a team that really needs to do that heading into next year to save some jobs and fan sanity and things like that, you wrote a terrific and lengthy piece on what the Blue Jays could do to rebuild this thing for 2025, given, you know, the decisions that they made at the trade deadline, given what the free agent landscape looks like, given some budget assumptions and things like that. Having gone through that exercise at length and in detail as you did, Travis, how are you feeling big picture about the Jays' ability to be competitive again, once again in 2025, given where they are right now?
Yeah, they are in a very tough spot, given their neighborhood, given payroll is significant, the resources they already have allocated for next year. And we don't have, you know, I made some assumptions with the budget in there. So I was projecting slight growth, but remaining under the luxury tax threshold. So they are in a tough spot. And but it seems like from their actions at the deadline and that they are not going to undergo any sort of dramatic rebuild this winter or next season. So I put on my GM hat and said, okay, they are going to run it back one more year. And what could potentially make this team competitive? And I do think, and we can get more into the details of the piece, but I do think the one positive is the toughest thing to try to turn around in one offseason would be a starting pitching staff. And I think it's in reasonable good shape right now, especially with how Francis has been pitching. I think it's 115 innings now he has in his career. He's got a sub-1 whip and a 3.03 ERA. So the new splitter, the command, he looks like he's going to be a very valuable pitcher moving forward. And Barrios and Bassett and Gausman have generally been very durable and very, I know they're not quite at last season's level, but to have durable innings eaters for the most part is still incredibly valuable. So I think the rotation is generally something they can feel okay to possibly good about. And then you look at, okay, that's in a decent place. The bullpen needs an overhaul. So we can get to that too, but and the other positive thing I think is they've had some young bats, pre-arbitration cohort of players that have emerged on the offensive side that they've either traded for, like Wilbur Fido or Spencer Horwitz, who's come up and looked like a really good player who I think they can a lot of plate appearances to next year. So I think at the very least the offensive floor is going to be raised, and I think those guys might even have, you know, another level next year, and they'll be cheap. So the Blue Jays can cut down on the number of arbitration eligible players they have to allot to their roster, which creates some payroll flexibility, given the assumptions I made with that. And then they do, I think, externally need to add an impact bat or two. But just to summarize this this long-winded answer. I do think it is a challenge, but they do have some strengths to build around. And you know, to compete next year, they're going to have a bold offseason plan. They need to increase their offensive production. I mean, I looked at all the AL East champions since 1995, and on average, there's never been a below 100 OPS plus team to win the division. The average is 110, meaning you're 10% above average. The average amount of home runs to win the division is 209, like 826 runs. You have to be a great offensive team. So I think that has to be a focus too, but I'll stop there.
Well, you certainly can't be 24th in home runs and, you know, right near the top in home runs allowed. Like, I'm using an oversimplification here, but if you are at that big a home run deficit, they have moved back past the Rockies for most home runs allowed. So, yeah, you can't do that. It's pretty straightforward. You could get away with maybe one of those things being a lower home run team or giving up a lot, but you can't be at a minus 44 home run deficit and expect to compete in the AL East. So a lot of good points there, Travis, you know, especially, hey, they've added a lot of these young guys. They look like competent, you know, bench or maybe even platoon type players. And it's important to have those inexpensive guys because that's what allows you the payroll flexibility. Go out and sign an Anthony Santander, or an Alex Bregman, someone like that. I don't know how realistic those specific targets are, but that's kind of where you're looking, right? Like, you're going to need two bats, whether it's third base, left field, second base, DH. And again, all these young players being positionally flexible gives you some offseason flexibility as well. If we assume that the Jays are not going to be players for Juan Soto or aren't going to be able to lure him from New York at least, what does that look like? Is it a Santander Bregman combo, that's kind of the best case scenario on the position player side?
Yeah, I tried to avoid the total pipe dreams, which I put Soto and Alonso into that category. Okay. So I was trying to be within the realm of plausibility. And you know, the Blue Jays did make a run at Ohtani, so who knows? Maybe they'll make a run at that's an ownership decision. Yeah. But so I was trying to be within the realm of what could be possible, and I think Santander would be a perfect fit. Switch hitting middle of the order power bat to address the home run differential you noted. Bregman, I love. The last time the Blue Jays went out and got a former Astros impact player, it worked out pretty well in George Springer before he started to tail off a little bit as he descends down the aging, his mid-30s years. But Bregman, I don't know how realistic it is, but there's huge value in a third baseman who can, you know, impact the game on both sides of the ball. And interestingly, the Statcast tracking would have him hit, as a Blue Jay, he would have hit five more home runs this year, which suggests even with the Crawford boxes, Rogers is more favorable dimensions-wise to his batted ball profile. So I don't know. Those are the player archetypes I think that would fit well. I can't say for sure whether the specific names. But, yeah, I think one of the silver linings, I think, that's come out of this season is the positional flexibility, the payroll flexibility of some of these younger position players will potentially help them add a larger external bat or player than if they're having to tender, more arbitration-eligible players or having to address bench players in free agency, which I don't think they have to do as much. So that is the silver line of the season that will, theoretically let them allow to attack some high tier options in free agency.
Yeah, you don't have to go out and spend 2 years, $15 million on IKF, who was a good piece for them and turned into a good prospect in Charles McAdoo. But ideally, you have that player internally. You don't have to spend $10 million on Kevin Kiermaier as a fourth outfielder because you have that guy internally, and then you can kind of funnel that money toward the real impact stuff. Travis, thank you so much for taking the time, my man. It was a great piece. Recommend everyone go read Assessing What the 2025 Blue Jays Could Look Like up at the Score and up on your Twitter page as well. Travis, thanks so much, man.
Thank you. Always great to be with you.
Travis Sochik of the Score. A lot of work ahead for the Toronto Blue Jays to make this into a 2025, a competitive 2025 team. Yes, they've played a little better of late. Yes, they're only five games under 500. At this point, the final record might not look all that bad, but obviously this is a team that even in a not weaker American League because the AL Central is stronger than we anticipated, but the West is a little weaker. You know, the Yankees and Orioles didn't quite run away to a 100-win pace like maybe was anticipated at the beginning of the year. Certainly a missed opportunity season for the Blue Jays. Had they been 3, 4, or 5 games better in April, May, June, you know, maybe you don't pull the plug, maybe you don't go in that direction. But this is where they are, and that ability to restock at least the 40-man depth and maybe even a little bit sub-40-man depth, it's not the sexiest item, but it's important. And like Travis outlined there, that's how you have the financial flexibility to go out and sign big-name guys, is that you don't have to nickel and dime the rest of the roster because you have those guys affordable and you have them young, and they're exciting. It's been a lot of fun over the last couple weeks to go down to the park and watch these young guys perform. Watch Bowden Francis turn in a no-hit bid. Watch Will Wagner have a, well, not a 5-hit game at home, but tune in and watch a 5-hit game. There is still lots of reason to watch September baseball. It's also a great time to be down at the ballpark. You know, obviously you'd rather be in a playoff race, but it's a lot of fun to, you know, not quite have the same stress level and to focus on the young guys and the development and things like that. The Blue Jays also have a lot planned for us for September. So let's talk to Jess Wood, the Toronto Blue Jays Director of Promotions, about what's coming this month. Jess, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
I am wonderful. I also found out heading into this that you are a family member of my good friend John Heymans.
I am. So I hope that means you'll be nice to me today.
I was going to be nice regardless. I was not going to hit you with a, hey, what are you, the director of promotions, doing to fix the roster? I wasn't going to hit you with that. But let's start at a high level. What do you guys have cooking for September? It seems like a pretty fun list of not just giveaways, but event nights at Rogers Center.
Yeah, we have a ton of great stuff going on. And I think our biggest message for fans is that summer's not over yet. It might be the final month of our regular season, but we are packed with promotions down at the ballpark. 14 home games, and 12 of them feature either a giveaway or a theme day.
Nice. And it's also like 23 and sunny today. So if, you know, tomorrow's supposed to be.
It's good vibes down here.
So, okay, on the giveaway side, have you been able to put aside a Grateful Dead? I know that is a specialty ticket item on September 14th, but that's the one that I feel like as media, I got to get my hands on.
Are you a bit of a Deadhead?
I like the vibe and the essay. The music itself, yeah, whatever. But I loved the giveaway last year. I like the general aesthetic and vibe around it. For clarity, what is a specialty ticket for that one and university and college night? If you're a college or university student or you're a Deadhead, what is a specialty ticket entail?
So specialty tickets are great in the sense that by buying a specialty ticket, you guarantee yourself the item. So no need to line up early like the rest of our giveaways. So for university and college night, you bring your school down. It's in session now. You make some new friends during Frosh Week. You come down, you can get a Blue Jays tumbler. So nice mug to bring your drinks, your cool drinks to class or wherever you're going. And then on the 14th, which is Saturday, we have our Grateful Dead Day. This is the second year that we've done this. And by buying your specialty ticket, you get a Grateful Dead bucket hat that matches the t-shirt from last night really nicely. You got the Jerry Bears on there.
Nice. That's great. Yeah. And then non-specialty ticket ones is the City Connect short sleeve hoodie on the 9th and the Fannel shirt giveaway on the 27th, part of Fan Appreciation Weekend. Can you tell us a little bit about Fan Appreciation Weekend beyond just the Fannel shirt?
Yeah, we use Fan Appreciation Weekend to celebrate the best fans in the game. So the regular season, final series, we celebrate our fans with September 27th to 29th at the ballpark. There's extra special activities and surprises all weekend long, and a great opportunity for our fans to win some great prizes down at the ballpark. We also have our Jays Care Garage Sale, which is a fan favorite on both Friday and Saturday. So lots of opportunity for people to head down and get their hands on some goodies.
Yeah, and in addition to that, I should just mention the Jays Care Foundation auction is coming up as well, not related to what we're talking about here, but of note for fans as well. There are also still, tonight's the third to last Looney Dog Night. This is not really a question about September, but in general, your group in the promotions department, how big a success has the Looney Dog Night thing been? It feels like it's still like something people talk about every single Tuesday home game.
It's created quite a following. And honestly, back a few years ago when we were doing research on how do we make dollar hot dogs work up north, I never could have imagined it would have taken off like this. So we're super proud of Looney Dogs. And tonight we are going to exceed 600,000, which is pretty incredible. And we're only 100,000 hot dogs off from from last year's record. So encouraging fans to get down here, three more, eat as many hot dogs as you can. It's do it for a cause. We're chasing history here.
Yeah, it's, I'd have to look at Shai Davidi's metrics of hot dogs per fan and hot dog per game and things like that to see if you're going to break the 700,000 mark. Last question for you. In general, how has this season been for your department in terms of engaging fans and things like that? Like, obviously, the season hasn't gone how we wanted, but with things like Looney Dog Nights, the Junior J Saturdays and stuff like that, you guys still finding... a good vibe and a good response to what you're doing on the promotional side?
I think for us, it's super important, regardless of team performance, to deliver the best fan experience for our team. We've got a really exciting young team. You were speaking about it a bit earlier, and all these guys are looking to make their mark in the big leagues. And it's exciting to get people down here with a reason, whether it's hot dogs, whether it's work from dome, whether it's a short sleeve hoodie. So hopefully they can experience that and build some momentum going into to next year. And we really think our fan experience is unmatched regardless of what's happening on the field.
Yeah, it's been cool. So I mean, I'm in the media seats most of the time, but I'm doing my special thing tonight is, yeah, I'll get my pregame out of the way, my media duties, and then I'll go sit in seats with friends. So it's always a lot of fun. Jess, thanks so much for taking the time out.
Thank you. See you tonight, maybe.
Yes, Jess Wood, Director of Promotions for the Toronto Blue Jays. Another Looney Dog Night tonight, a work from dome game tomorrow. 14 home games of these final 23 games for the Blue Jays. And they're not in a playoff race like we would have wanted them to be, but they are still playing baseball games, playing them against teams that are in playoff races and desperately need the wins. And look, giving a lot of opportunity to young guys who are making these early auditions for 2025, like we kind of talked with Travis there and Julia earlier. Tonight, it'll be Tyler Phillips against Chris Bassitt. Tyler Phillips, probably not a guy you've seen a lot of yet this year, coming up for the Phillies. Again, like we talked about with Adam, Taijuan Walker getting bounced to the bullpen as rosters expand. Tyler Phillips comes up. He made six starts early in the year. He comes in with a 5.50 ERA. Interesting statistical profile. Like, obviously, 36 innings is not enough to judge a guy entirely. But there's some interesting stuff there. Like, he gets hit pretty hard. However, because of the nastiness of his sweeper, he's able to get some good swing or some good chase outside of the zone. He's primarily coming in sinker sweeper, but I also throw a four seamer, a curveball. He'll throw a change up to lefty. So a lot to prep for when it comes to Tyler Phillips for the Blue Jays team. But yeah, you can get to him. He's been hit pretty hard when guys do make contact. It just happens to be that they chase outside of the zone. He's an interesting guy too, in that he doesn't really walk anyone. So maybe it's a case where, as he figures out his pitch mix and how to attack guys and things like that, he starts to work outside of the zone a little bit more because, hey, guys are chasing it out there. I'm not walking anyone. I trust my stuff inside the zone. Maybe he's still figuring out how to come back inside the zone without grooving one down the heart. We'll see. He's an interesting pitcher, not one that we've seen a ton of yet. Chris Bassitt is one we know very, very well, and he has a lot of history against this Phillies team. Of course, some of that history is going to be pretty outdated from his time with the Mets. Nick Castellanos has faced him 29 times. He's 10 for 28 with 5 extra base hits, so pretty good results there. Kyle Schwarber's had a bit of a tough time against Bassitt. Alec Bohm's had a really tough time against Chris Bassitt, as has Bryson Stott. And Bryce Harper is 0 for 8 with 3 strikeouts against Chris Bassitt. Overall, this Phillies team in 120 plate appearances has hit just .232 with a .348 slug against Chris Bassitt. So potentially a good matchup for him there. It's a 7:07 start. It's Dan, Joe, and Arden on the TV call for you. Jamie and Madison on Blue Jay Central. I will join them for a little bit pregame as well. Ben and Chris on the radio call, and Shai Davidi and Ben Nicholson-Smith and David Singh all down there. Thank you to Julia Kreutz, Adam Aronson, Jake Mintz, Travis Sochik, and Jess Wood for joining us today. Thank you to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass as usual. We will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break this one down, to set you up for a 3 p.m. game tomorrow. The Phillies in and out of town real quick here. That's about it. That's all we got. Hope you have a wonderful Tuesday. We will talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow.